Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Right after the 9/11 attack 16 years ago, Congress passed the AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force. It gave the Bush administration broad authority to use force against any persons, organizations, or nations who were responsible for the attacks. Since then, the AUMF has been used by Bush, Obama, and Trump to bypass Congress and use military force in numerous countries and against a variety of groups. On Monday, October 30th, Secretary of Defense James Mattis and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson urged Congress not to repeal the AUMF. But if they do, they want its scope to be even broader. Here is James Mattis testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Any new AUMF must not be time restricted. For example, President Trump's South Asia strategy is conditions-based, not time-based, because war is fundamentally unpredictable. We cannot put a firm timeline on conflict against an adaptive enemy who would hope that we haven't the will to fight as long as necessary. Instead, we must recognize that we are in an era of frequent skirmishing, and we are more likely to end this fight sooner if we don't tell our adversary the day we intend to stop fighting. A conditions-based AUMF would not lessen Congress's authority. The power of the purse remains firmly vested in your hand should the executive branch not present a persuasive case for continuing the campaign.
And that is a clip from Secretary of Defense James Mattis testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on October 30th, telling Congress not to repeal the AUMF. In his new book, The War and Environment Reader, today's guest, Gar Smith, writes that entire generations have grown up in a culture that accepts the idea of endless wars. But what is endless war costing the globe economically, psychologically, and environmentally? These are the questions a number of contributors explore in The War and Environment Reader. It provides a critical analysis of the devastating consequences of militarism and the war on the environment. Gar Smith is editor emeritus of Earth Island Journal and a former editor of Common Ground magazine. He's co-founder of Environmentalists Against War, and Gar Smith joins me in studio. Hi, Gar. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. What do you think of Secretary of Defense James Mattis saying that war is fundamentally unpredictable and we're in an era of frequent skirmishing?
Well, this is a man who is a military careerist, and his nickname is Mad Dog. Taking that into consideration, I think it's to his convenience that he sees the situation in this light. War, he sees, as something that's perpetual, that you respond to with skirmishes, and there's no room for diplomacy. I think there are other routes that have been proven, and I don't think that it's a good foreign policy to turn the entire world into a free fire zone for American weapons.
The book that you wrote includes essays by a number of contributors focusing on everything from the financial cost of war, the environmental cost of war, the psychological cost of war, from Indian country to Vietnam, and really everywhere in between. And you write that our hope is that this collection of essays will illuminate the economic, political, and cultural drivers of permawar, detailing the cascading dangers of terricide, and provide guideposts and goals for achieving equilibrium, a human presence on Earth that is more in balance with nature. One way or another, our planet will be transformed. Let's strive for a peaceful, just, and sustainable future. What did you hope to accomplish by taking on this project?
I wanted to go beyond just a recitation of various disgraces against the natural world in the course of wars around the planet. That's a third of the book. That's the terricide section. We also wanted to explore the causes of war, why we find ourselves in the West primarily fixated on violent solutions to tension. And then we wanted to provide solutions. with my background at Earth Island and Friends of the Earth, Dave Brower, he always instructed us, if you present a problem, that's well and good, but you've got to do more than that. You can't leave people at the end of your article without knowing what they can do to solve the problem. So we always had a what you can do section at the bottom of every revelation. Interesting part for me is the first part, the section that looks into causes, motivations, and drivers for the strange psychology that we must always face challenges with bravery and audacity and mercilessness. What is it that pulls us away from looking for common solutions and pursuing peace? And we have a lot to deal with in Western culture, going clear back to our most ancient writings, the epics of Gilgamesh, fierce warriors, battling monsters, even the Holy Bible. One of the first examples of scorched earth tactics appears in the Book of Judges, where Samson is depicted as a very unique form of scorched earth. He gathered together 30 foxes, and he tied them together in pairs. And then he tied a torch to each of the pairs and lit the torch and unleashed the flaming foxes into the fields of the Philistines to destroy their crops. And wars have been doing this ever since, destroying crops, poisoning common water supplies, depriving people of the means to inhabit villages, driving them from their lands. And then, of course, more recently, we've expanded that to chemical warfare against entire ecosystems, as in Vietnam, where we had forests that were not dying as collateral damage, but they were being destroyed as a primary target. This problem that we have with violent resolutions needs to be addressed. And fortunately, we have some new initiatives that are coming out, new treaties to abolish nuclear weapons, campaigns to divest from military producers, the campaign to close foreign U.S. military bases, and a greater reliance on international problem solving.
You write that the United States maintains tens of thousands of troops stationed at more than 1,000 bases in more than 60 foreign countries. The Pentagon deploys troops in nearly 150 foreign lands. War has become one of this country's biggest exports. Five of the world's largest war profiteering companies are based in the United States. This is not something that we have that many conversations about in the national media and the national dialogue. Do you think that the public at large realizes that there are more than 1,000 bases in 60 countries?
I think we have very little idea of the expanse of our global footprint. People aren't comfortable with the phrase that puts the word empire together with the United States, but this is one of the big room-filling elephants. The United States is an empire. We occupy, we have bases in more than 130 overseas countries. We have, our own country is occupied with about 6,000 military installations. The thunder of our weapons are heard around the world. We, even when we aren't at war, we invented this process of military exercises, which provides a means to draw down the inventory of stored bombs and bullets. If they aren't used, they can't be replaced. If they can't be replaced, we don't make our profits. So we have military exercises ongoing and constant all around the world, at land, at sea. That's a big part of the overall conundrum of our military industrial complex. We no longer live in a representative republic, let alone a democracy. We live in an oligarchy, a kakistocracy, And when you tie together the military and Wall Street, War Street and Wall Street, they work in tandem. And you have a situation that I've started calling a corporate militocracy as a description of our form of government and economy.
Let's talk about the essay included in the War and Environment Reader, War is a Racket, by Major General Smedley Butler. This was written in 1935. Before we read part of this, tell us about Major General Smedley Butler.
Smedley Butler was one of the most decorated people in the Marine Corps. He served overseas in many forward deployments in other countries in South America, in Asia. He came to realize later in his career that he had been, in his own words, a gangster for capitalism, who could teach Al Capone a few lessons. He went on to start writing pamphlets, and he had a radio program. He became an anti-war revelationist, talking about his exploits, exposing corruption, and proposing a new path for national behavior. He said, "It's if you want to put an end to war, you've got to take the profit out of it. If you want to put an end to war, you've got to confine your forces to defending the homeland in the homeland. Ships don't have to go more than 200 miles offshore to be protective. If it's defensive, you should also vote on every war. And the people who vote on the war, it's got to be the ones who fight it, not the ones who profit from it." And Smedley Butler's suggestions still make a lot of sense today.
I want to read just a little bit from this essay. Again, this is 1935. Smedley Butler wrote, "I spent 35 years and 4 months in active military service as a member of the country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. I served in all commissioned ranks from second lieutenant to major general. And during that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefits of Wall Street." It goes on, Nicaragua, Dominican Republic. "In China, I helped to see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested." He was so brutally honest about what he did. What sort of reaction did he get back then in 1935?
Well, there was an interesting turn that happened. He was approached by some very powerful businessmen, oil people, and banking interests, and the American Legion, and they offered him a proposition. They wanted somebody who could rally the troops and lead an assault on the White House, seize it, arrest Federal Delano Roosevelt, and install a new business-friendly government. Smedley Butler wasn't that kind of guy. He played along, and he took notes, and he went public, and he caused an investigation that led to a cover-up. Most Americans don't know about this attempted business coup against the elected government of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But thanks to Smedley Butler, it is a matter of historical record.
In 1935, he also wrote, "In the World War, a mere handful garnered the profits of the conflict. At least 21,000 new millionaires and billionaires were made in the United States during the World War. That many admitted their huge blood gains in their income tax returns." And then, as you said, he ends by saying, "There is only one way to disarm with any semblance of practicality. That is for all nations to get together and scrap every ship, every gun, every rifle, every tank, every warplane."
Hear, hear.
Well, as you write, though, this is so embedded now into not only society, but the economy of this country. And you've got both parties. I mean, under Obama, the Department of Defense budget increased and increased. I mean, Bernie Sanders barely touched on this issue when he ran for office. A lot of people wanted him to spend more time talking about military spending, and he just didn't do it. So when you have both parties on board, how do you tackle this? And the revolving door with both parties?
Well, we need other parties. And it's still an enigma that Bernie wouldn't touch that topic. He's a socialist, my God. What does it take? I think that's one of the paths that's clearly open, that that we need a new political force in American politics. We've become so estranged from the forces that are trying to dictate to us that it beggars the imagination. You want to hope for some kind of a savior. You want to pick somebody who's going to. Bernie had that position. I'm currently enamored of Republican Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii. But the problems that that Butler described, they're still absolutely common. I have two litanies here. One from David Swanson from World Beyond War. It's a good scene setter for what we're dealing with today. He wrote recently, since World War II, the Pentagon has bombed more than 30 countries, killed some 20 million people, overthrown at least 36 governments, interfered in at least 82 foreign elections, and attempted to assassinate over 50 foreign leaders. The U.S. is responsible for the deaths of 5 million people in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. And then this is a sentence I try to do in a single breath, and it's hard. Since the Pentagon's retreat from Vietnam in 1973, U.S. forces have targeted Afghanistan, Angola, Argentina, Bosnia, Cambodia, El Salvador, Grenada, Haiti, Iran, Iraq, Kosovo, Kuwait, Lebanon, Libya, Nicaragua, Pakistan, Panama, the Philippines, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, Ukraine, Yemen, and the former Yugoslavia. This is the face that we present to the world. We talk about our brave men and women fighting for democracy, risking their lives to spread democracy. Two recent studies dispute that. The U.S. is currently arming 73% of the world's dictatorships. Freedom House, their rating of 49 nations of the world as being dictatorships, we're arming 36 of them. A poll recently conducted by Gallup International asked the question of 65,000 people around the world, what is the greatest threat to peace on this planet? The answer resoundingly was the United States of America. In fourth position, with only 4% of the vote, were the countries Afghanistan, Iran, Israel, and North Korea.
Today, we are speaking with Gar Smith about his new book, The War and Environment Reader. And if you have any questions or comments for Gar, we would love to hear from you. We're talking about perpetual war. Gar talks about the financial costs of war, the social costs of war, the environmental costs of war. How do we tackle this issue at a time when both parties increase the military budget, and at a time when Bernie Sanders really didn't talk much about this issue when he was running? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255.
This program was pre-recorded. This is a rebroadcast. We're not taking calls this morning, but thank you.
I know that there are so many longtime peace activists listening to the show. In fact, Gar, you came in with your peace. I think it says Peace is Patriotic button, Veterans for Peace. So what are your thoughts about the movement also, the anti-war movement, and where it is today? I'd love to hear from those of you who are involved in the anti-nuke movement. What are your thoughts about what we're dealing with today? Gar has one of these things that just, when I was reading about how we're going to soon see war robots. I mean, we thought drones are horrific, but war robots? We'll talk about that in just a couple minutes. Let's hear from Phil in San Francisco. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Hi, Gar Smith. Several comments. First off, what tickled my memory was back in the early 80s, I happened to come across a book that had been in print for some time. It was called, titled, The Failure of American Diplomacy, then too commonly in public education even, we knew that the language of diplomacy was French, not, you know, American English. And then, too, in our symbolism, the seal of the eagle with the arrows in one hand and the olive branch in the other, they changed the direction of the beak back in the 1930s. I don't know if your guest would know more about that. And it's like, it almost is like the beginning of the cover-up, and don't look at what we do, look at who we are or something. So anyway, I'm here. I endured the Vietnam era. I'm 69 and a half this month, and sad to see. Oh, then too, I'd like to comment, and also for Rose, maybe in a future show you can work on why is the American populace sleeping in their, exercising their voice in the elections. In other words, currently the last election showed about half of the electorate voting. And so many people don't realize that this is a representational democracy instead of a direct democracy.
Well, thank you for calling in, Phil. Gar?
The symbol is interesting. I suspect that when the image of the eagle turned its other beak, that may have coincided with the rebranding of the War Department as the Defense Department, and also the redirection of our American foreign policy into a more decidedly military bent.
Can you tell us about that rebranding effort?
No.
The War Department?
just that it was, and it's obviously why it was.
Well, what about that word defense? Department of Defense. We spend this much on defense. Lockheed Martin is a defense company. What about that word?
That's a big part of the problem, that we can't change things until we start using the right language. In my writings, I never refer to the Defense Department. It's always the Pentagon. We have to be careful about the words we use. Our language, of course, is also infiltrated with militaries. We talk about our aims, our targets, our strategies. We talk about being blown away, about all kinds of insidious little intrusions of military lingo into our language. And it would help if we try purging that from our dialogue. It's gotten so bad. We have all of these environmental and anti-war organizations that put out these appeals. 16 years of war in Afghanistan. It's gone on too long. And then at the bottom of the pitch, it says, keep fighting. You see that a lot. Look for it.
Keep fighting?
Yeah, that was the Daily Kos. And they're not alone.
Huh. Before we go to break, what about the history of war and the U.S. military in this country? I mean, a lot of people don't even know about that. And can you talk about why that's important? You've got an essay by Winona LaDuc, a Native activist of Honor the Earth. We had her on when she wrote her book about the militarization of Native lands. And this is just really important because she writes about how much of what is today U.S. military land was at some time taken from Native peoples, sometimes at gunpoint, sometimes in the wake of massacres, of forced marches through starvation, sometimes through pen and paper, broken treaties. I mean, we can do a whole show on this, but she writes about Pueblo land wounded by nuclear bombs, Alaska, occupied territory, Western Shoshone, nuclear test, atomic waste, the Yakima Nation, a reservation for nuclear waste, Hawaii, native land seized by the military. I mean, it just goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the importance of really understanding this history to figure out, you know, how we got here today and how we can really tackle this issue.
Mm-hmm. The first essay in the book, in the first section of the book, is by Vandana Shiva, the great Indian activist. She points out that we tend to treat the land the way that we treat women. Mother Earth is defiled regularly for Profit and Gain. The title of her article is Treating Nature Like Dirt. The Native Americans and the Native peoples around the world have been uniformly treated as disposable. Their land has been torn apart for minerals, for uranium, for precious minerals. Their lands have then been used as dumping grounds for the wastes that are produced by these industrial processes. They've been dispossessed. It's a common theme among colonial powers to exploit the land of the indigenous people and leave it in disrepute and ruin.
According to the 2013 UN Environment Program report, at least 40% of all interstate conflicts involve the exploitation of natural resources, land, water, diamonds, timber, minerals, and, of course, oil.
And it will continue to be that way until we start redesigning our future. I came across an interesting tidbit yesterday. 1952, there was something called the Paley Commission, reported to President Truman, and they recommended that instead of taking the country down the nuclear path, we should invest in solar. Solar power, back in 1952. Dwight Eisenhower had the same report, but he chose the nuclear path. We still have these choices, and they are becoming manifest down in Puerto Rico. Elon Musk has just restarted the destroyed electrical grid using solar panels, and there's more talk now about taking this disaster as an opportunity to not just rebuild in the same old mode, but to redesign the country to make it survivable in this new world that we're creating around ourselves. We have terraformed the planet, and we have to redesign our lives and redesign our thinking if we have any intention to continue living here.
Today we are speaking with Gar Smith about the new book, The War and Environment Reader. He edited this book. It includes writings from a number of contributors, including Daniel Ellsberg, Jane Goodall, Jerry Mander, and they look at the consequences of war, the environmental, social, psychological, and environmental causes of war. This is Your Call's One Planet series, and we'll be back after this.
We're listening to a rebroadcast of a program that has aired previously in the last few months. We're not taking phone calls this morning. You're always welcome to leave a message and offer comments by email to yourcall@klw.org. A comment on our website at yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio. Again, we're not taking phone calls this morning. This program was pre-recorded. Thank you for listening and enjoy the program.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are speaking with Gar Smith. He edited the new book, The War and Environment. It provides a critical analysis of the devastating consequences of militarism and the war on the environment. Gar Smith is editor emeritus of the Earth Island Journal, and he's co-founder of Environmentalists Against War. And let's hear from Hitty in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I appreciate the topic. I just feel that every time we talk about these types of things, like militarism, that we are not connecting the dots. What really needs to happen for us to become effective politically is to understand the underpinnings of psychopathy within our political system. So for people who don't know what I'm talking, there are people who do know what I'm talking about. There's people who don't know. So to make this meaningful to people who don't know what I'm talking about, you need to begin to understand why let's say, for example, Satanism was made a protected, you know, given the status of a religion within the military in the 80s. I'm not personally Christian. I don't personally believe in Satan. But there is such a thing as a cult that can be formed to shape people to violate their own children and to undergo like a training process to become a psychopath. And so psychopathy is interconnected with militarism, money laundering, and child abuse.
All right, Hitty, thank you for your comment. What do you think about the psychopathic elements of this, Gar?
It's definitely a benefit to have a psychopath behind the muzzle of a gun if you're interested in causing damage and death. The problem that the military has always had is that people are not necessarily predisposed to killing one another. It was a big problem during World War One. Many of the young men were fresh off farms, and they'd only shot at squirrels, and they really were not prone to draw a bead on fellow humans, even though they were described as demons and subhuman. They would tend not to fire their guns. They would fire their guns in the air. The Second World War tried to put an end to that by creating psychopaths through boot camps and dehumanizing people by, as they put it, breaking them down and building them up again to remove the human predilection for respecting life and to turn people more into automatons that could be just ordered and be more like robots than humans. Of course, the robots is the next stage, and it's the ideal soldier.
This is very disturbing. I mean, it's all disturbing, but this one, you write that in South Korea, Samsung robots have replaced human guards along the border with North Korea. When these robots detect the approach of a human, they demand a password. If they don't hear the correct answer, they automatically open fire.
That's very efficient, isn't it?
This is happening right now.
Yeah.
Why isn't this getting more attention?
Well, I'm surprised because we do have this culturally enforced fascination with robots and all things mechanical. And it certainly is appealing to people who have that frame of mind. A lot of money is being made on building, in one way, replicants of nature. The military designers have... You can go on YouTube and find these automatons they've created to look like fish, like snakes, like oxen, like horses, birds, but they're all mechanical. There's a small flying sparrow that's been designed as a surveillance unit. It has its own television monitoring system, and it looks and flies like a small sparrow. But they also have created these robots that can infiltrate people's homes, small as a cricket, weighing as much as a penny, and they can spy on people in their homes. They also have a robot that can fly silently up behind somebody in, for example, a combat situation in a building, say. And while they're looking out the window, lining up a target through their sights, the small robot hovering behind their heads will suddenly explode, killing them.
You write that when these robots detect the approach of a human, they demand a password, and if they don't hear the answer, they automatically open fire. Does this happen on a regular basis? I mean, has anyone been killed? Do we know?
I don't have the answer to that. My guess is that if word is out that there are such sentries on duty, if you don't have a password, you're not going to go anywhere near that place.
You write that DARPA's ultimate goal is to take the man out of unmanned warfare by building warbots with the capacity to make their own decisions about who to kill and when. On November 21st, 2012, the Pentagon issued a 15-page directive describing an autonomous weapons system that, once activated, can select and engage targets without human supervision. The Pentagon has envisioned a $130 billion robot army. And I should say that this essay was actually written by you. I wanted to give credit where credit's due, but you did write this one. Can you tell us more about this? And what is the time frame here? I mean, in 2012, they issued a 15-page directive. What's the status of this?
I don't know what the current status is, but all of these programs are ongoing. I did recently see a television broadcast of something that I'd written about, the creation of these autonomous bots that can swarm. They're flying, they get up in the sky, they're small. There's been something like this seen in public with drones, massive armadas of drones that are choreographed to dance in the sky and create nice patterns. But these are robots that are autonomous, and they're designed to flock and form their own strategic airborne armadas. They become cognizant of one another, position in space and time, and then they move to execute certain forms of surveillance or assault. And they were actually on display in the air, I believe, over Nevada, showing how they all are released from different spots and how they congeal in the sky and how they start to coordinate and form a unified, almost a presence in the air. And they're working this out on their own. It's happening without human intervention.
Let's go next to John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose. Thank you for this very important program. I hope you do more like it. And I'd like to thank Mr. Smith for bringing the story of Smedley Butler to the public. I hope he sends Mr. Butler's story to Oliver Stone. Maybe Oliver Stone can do a movie so we can understand that war and violence are not the answer to our problems in this world. I think that one of the most important arguments against war and violence is it's not working. We went to war against Al-Qaeda, and we killed Osama bin Laden, but one of the best secrets these days is that Al-Qaeda is stronger than ever as we go off and fight ISIS. So it's really crazy. And the other issue I'd like to raise is that it seems to me that our children are raised on this brainwashed idea that violence is the answer. We have the movie Star Wars, and we have all these video games that involve violence. And I think that it's steering their thinking in the wrong way.
Well, thank you, John. You brought up a couple points there. It is not working, but it is working for Lockheed Martin, the world's largest arms dealer, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics. Gar, you write that in 2014, total sales for the top six arms makers topped $241 billion. Can you give us a little bit of insight about how these daily contracts are given out? Often no-bid contracts. There's no debate on this. The public doesn't even really know this is happening, because it doesn't get much coverage.
Right, yeah. If Smedley Butler is writing today, the title of his pamphlet might be War is a Scam. This is just a big money-making operation. It is totally corrupt. Hollywood makes films under the tutelage of the CIA and the Defense Department. If you want to make a movie about the war, you want to show a Sikorsky helicopter, you need to borrow one from the Army, the Pentagon gets to look at your script. The culture is perpetuating this sense that the military is a glamorous, fulfilling occupation. We have new shows on television now. The new shows used to be cop shows. They used to be procedurals. They used to be hospital dramas. Now we've got a program called SWAT, Domestic Militarized Police. Now we've got a program debuting called SEALs. They're just burying us under all of these cultural imperatives that are useful for them but dangerous for us. The Pentagon, it's true, it does not work. The Pentagon hasn't won a war since 1945, arguably, and that is largely thanks to the Russians who fought and died so valiantly, if one can say valiant in a situation like that. The Pentagon, we're spending more than $1 trillion a year fighting wars and preparing to fight wars, and what have we accomplished? The Pentagon cannot account for $6.5 trillion of spending. It's been this way for 20 years. The Pentagon is the only agency of the U.S. government that has not been audited. After a lot of pressure, it said it was going to be ready for an audit on September 30th. That day has gone. The Pentagon is a wasteful, corrupt system, and the beneficiaries are those large corporations that you have named and many others that have infiltrated the political system, that have put bases and manufacturing operations in all of the states so that every representative can be put under pressure. If you want those jobs, if you want political donations, it's quid pro quo. It's a major infrastructural problem that we have. And if we get this message out that war doesn't work, it's a failure, it costs too much, it's a ripoff, it's corrupt, out with it. We gotta call it as we see it. The Pentagon is a disaster, if I may use a word from Trump's vocabulary.
According to a study by the World Watch Institute, redirecting just 15% of the money spent on weapons globally could eradicate most of the immediate causes of war and environmental destruction. 15%.
Mm-hmm. The problems of education for women, the problems of clean water for the globe, the problems of desertification, all of these issues could be addressed with a minuscule amount of the money that's being absolutely wasted on these war profiteers.
Today we're speaking with Gar Smith, who edited the book, The War and Environment Reader. Thanks for the call, John. Let's go next to Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good stuff. A great show. I was hoping that sometime in the future, this show or you folks could take a look at the very suspicious arming and almost creation of the rebel groups in Syria who were trying to invade and overthrow that country. A lot of the weapons came from Libya. We're starting to see some of this now in the mainstream press. And this was Obama and Clinton. And so, you know, with last weekend's revelation, you know, that Hillary Clinton bought the Democratic Party a year before the primary, and now they're purging the progressive anti-war people out of the Democratic Party. I mean, we have a crisis. I mean, both parties are in the war thing, you know, up to their eyeballs, and we don't have any representation against this. I mean, this war that's going on in Syria is completely created by the U.S. with the coalition of Israel, Britain, Saudi Arabia. And, you know, I'm looking at a picture of John McCain sitting with al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS. I mean, these were Contras, just like it was in Central America, and this information is starting to come out. So I hope you'll take a look at that, maybe, you know, help turn it around or put some pressure on the Democrats. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, last December, Representative Tulsi Gabbard actually stood before the House on the floor and proposed that the United States was in violation of its own laws against funding terrorist organizations abroad. She specifically named the United States' support for the al-Qaeda, al-Nusra Front spinoffs in Syria, and pointed out the U.S. is on to providing weapons for both sides of the conflict. Actually, that conflict has more than both sides. It has many sides. And we're in the mix of supplying weapons willy-nilly to far too many.
We have a comment from Henry that says he's surprised to hear that you say you're enamored with Representative Gabbard, because she told the Hawaii Tribune last year, in short, when it comes to the war against terrorists, I'm a hawk. When it comes to counterproductive wars of regime change, I'm a dove.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's a good criticism. Nobody's perfect, and we keep searching for perfection. So those dings are well-deserved. She did say that.
Thank you for that, Henry. I'll share a couple of the articles he sent with you, Gar, after the show. I wish we had more time, because I really want to talk about how militarism affects people around the globe. I mean, we can do a show about every essay in the book. But, for example, even before the Bush invasion of Iraq, in the crowded hospitals of Iraq, women from Fallujah and other cities blasted by uranium weapons continue to deliver deformed babies, children born with the wrong number of fingers, legs, arms, eyes, and heads. You also write about the Gulf invasion. In 1991, you write about Kuwait's burning oil fields. From 92 to 2007, U.S. bombing and illegal logging destroyed 38% of Afghanistan's forest habitat. I mean, the list just goes on and on. Can you talk about what you learned just about how you write about birds in Afghanistan, you write about animals in Afghanistan? I mean, the human cost, the environmental cost, what really stood out for you specifically when we're talking about Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, actually, I'd like to tackle a bigger story. There are two existential threats to our planet. One is nuclear war. The other is climate change. The American military is responsible for both. We understand the link with nuclear weapons. We do not understand the fact that the military plays a major role, the major role in global warming. The pollution that is generated by the armed forces and its defense contractors, the military alone, 5% of all of the global warming gases, 15% all of the world's militaries, 15% of the global warming gases. The Pentagon's search for oil. The wars are for oil. That's been admitted. General Abizaid said, it's all about oil. That's clear. We can't deny it. We are fighting wars for oil. Why? Because we need oil. Why do we need oil to fight wars? We're fighting wars for oil to fight wars for oil. It's an endless cycle. The Army, two-thirds of the fuel that's used by the Army is consumed just by the trucks and boats and cargo vehicles that transport the oil to the battlefield. Only one-third of the oil is actually used in combat for the military's purpose. Most of it is just eaten up in shipping. Very wasteful. The oil, of course, is running out. We need to transition, and it's time that the planet stop paying the price in lost forests, lost wildlife, lost rivers, lost land, lost humanity, lost villages. And we don't need a world in which we have new terms like combat rubble or combat pollution. Entire cities have been destroyed. This is what warfare is in the modern times. It's the destruction of entire built cities, urban landscapes flattened, and they have to be rebuilt. But if you rebuild those, and bear in mind that when you destroy a city, anytime you burn something, anytime you see smoke, that's pollution. That is destabilizing the climate. We have cities that, if they are rebuilt, the rebuilding process itself is going to generate vast amount of climate-changing carbons from the construction and from the concrete, which is one of the most greenhouse gas impactful industrial endeavors around. It takes a lot of energy and produces a lot of pollution to create cement. Rebuilding cities is going to be intensely polluting.
The Pentagon burns 320,000 barrels of oil a day, despite being the planet's greatest institutional emitter of climate destabilizing gases. The Pentagon is exempt from reporting its pollution. Gar, we have just about 2 minutes left, and I wonder, I mean, as a longtime peace activist, someone who has you've dedicated your life to this issue, a lot of the guests who come on to talk about what should we do, they say that activists need to really get out of their silos and start working together on these issues. How would you analyze the anti-war movement today?
I think it's starting to revive and regenerate and expand in very positive ways. The one of the goals of the book is to form a better coalition between the environmental and the anti-war campaigns. Greenpeace got its start as an anti-war organization protesting nuclear testing off Alaska. The Veterans for Peace organization has been doing good environmental reporting about the impacts of war for many years. Great stuff. We're working with them in greater proximity than we have in the past, and I'm looking forward to even greater work in the future. There is one extraordinarily promising organization that's come about called World Beyond War. If this book appeals to people on the intellectual and emotional basis, there's a book that World Beyond War has that will answer to the strategic needs. It's called A Global Security System, an Alternative to War, and it's available online.
Well, we will definitely continue this conversation, Gar. It's really an incredible book. I mean, the essays are pretty intense, but really needed information. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you ever so much for having me.
Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio, and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Laura Flynn produced today's show. Lauren Schechter is our social media producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call's One Planet series.